part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm not doing part.
All right, well, shall we begin this podcast?
Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, this is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. My name is Christian Horn. I am on the line with my good friend Jay Holtham, returning to the podcast for the first time in a little while.
Hello.
And the reason we are here is because Part-Time Fanboy, during the month of October, if you don't know already, we like to go through some of our favorite or non-favorite or horror movies that we have not seen and talk about them, because it's October and it's Halloween time and I loves me some horror movies and Halloween, right?
Yes, please. Let's get spooky.
Yeah. Yeah. And this week we are going to chat about Candyman, which is a film that Jay picked. Jay, why did you pick Candyman?
I picked it because it's one of those movies that, like, I saw when I was young, when I was a teenager. I mean, it originally came out in, what was it, 85?
Uh-huh.
No,
92. Oh, no, 92.
Came out in, like, 92, and I remember it's one of those things that had, like, I was in high school or just graduated high school, and it had a real effect on me.
Really?
It lived with me for a while, but I have not revisited it. And it seemed like this seemed like a good time. Jordan Peele is talking about remaking it, and it seemed like, let's give this a whirl.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's interesting. I don't think I've ever seen this, like, all the way through. I think maybe I've seen clips on, like, horror documentaries, or maybe I've seen a little bit on cable, but I was surprised because I was like, I don't think I've ever seen this, which, again, surprised the hell out of me. I was just
I'm surprised to hear that.
Yeah. I mean, as far as I know, like, this is sort of like one of those iconic sort of like 90s horror movies, like, you know, things that you should have seen if you were into horror. But I think 92 was the year that I actually moved out to California. And, you know, there was a lot going on. So I probably, and I don't think I was into horror as much as I am now, as like back then as I am now. So I probably missed this thinking it was some like cheesy B movie thing in the league of like a Van Damme movie and stuff.
Right.
And you know, because that's what was popular at the time. God help us, Van Damme movies. But I was like, I watched it last night and I have to say, I was super pleasantly surprised with this.
Yeah, it's a really good movie. I mean, I haven't watched it since then. And it's one of those movies that's not, it's not quite a cult classic. It's not like Reanimator or, you know, Night of the Creeps or Return of the Living Dead or something like that.
Yeah.
It doesn't have quite that kind of feel, or it's certainly not that tone, but it doesn't have that that cult following. But I feel like it's the kind of movie that when you like mention it to someone and they've seen it, they're like, oh man, that fucked me up. And it sort of like disappeared as well. Like as when we were trying to do this, we realized that it's super hard to find. I don't think it's streaming anywhere.
Yeah. We couldn't find a place to stream it like with for free or even pay, like, really. It's not on Amazon. Yeah.
I think it might be on YouTube, someone said, but but yeah, but it's still, it's hard to find. It sort of seems to have like gone a little bit down a memory hole. So I honestly haven't seen it. I don't know if I've seen it since the first time I saw it in 92. So, or maybe, you know, shortly thereafter. So it was also a sort of a rediscovery. And also I was surprised at how much of it was still kind of indelibly marked in my brain.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like bits that I hadn't thought, like certainly the graffiti on the inside of the wall, like that came like rushing back to me. And obviously the gimmick of say Candyman's name five times.
Sure.
Definitely still gives me chills, and I still do not try to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Nobody should. Nobody should. Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, like I said, I don't think I've ever seen this all the way through. It's one of those things that like people talk about, have always talked about. Obviously it spawned like two sequels, which I did a little bit of reading, and they are nowhere near as good as this. Watching it last night, it's funny because it's one of those horror movies that I was watching with my wife, Amy, and we were sitting there and we're watching it. And she's like, looks up because she was actually working on something on her computer as she was kind of like watching it. And she turns to me and she's like, this is pretty good. And I was like, yeah, like, this is good. And it's funny to me because I don't necessarily think, I don't think it's scary per se, like, or maybe in a modern sensibility, it's not scary. But for me, it like really worked really well as like a drama. You know what I mean? With like supernatural underpinnings. Like I really felt like I was watching something that was trying to be a little bit more grown up than what the typical fare was doing at the time, particularly with the lead character's sort of like descent into sort of madness or like what is happening to her as the movie goes on. Yeah, I was just really surprised as to how sort of, I don't know if mature is the right word, but mature this whole thing seemed to me.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like, to think about it, feels tonally very much more modern. Like it feels, it's not quite as arty as something like It Follows or The Babadook, and there are some frights in it, but you're right that it's mostly like full of a pervasive sense of dread and a deep sense of like WTF is even happening. Especially, you know, it's sort of, I mean, we'll talk about the plot in a second, but there are sort of two halves to it. And it's the second half when the, like the supernatural stuff really starts happening, where all of a sudden, because there really isn't anything supernatural for like the a long chunk of the beginning of the movie.
Like 45 minutes, I timed it.
And
I
was like, Tony Todd does not show up into this movie until way late.
Yeah, because the whole thing of the part of the movie is like seeking like mythology or myths or urban legends and stuff like that. And the first half of the movie is just her sort of like investigating this urban legend of the Candyman, which you might have to explain to me why he's called the Candyman. I don't sort of, maybe I was tired. I didn't pick up on it. I don't know.
It's not super clear. I mean, there's, because what they detail in it, I mean, I guess it has to do with, you know, with the honey. What they detail in it is that, you know, the spirit that Tony Todd is, and it's a little also, it's Clive Barker. So
sure.
The details are always a little hazy, and he doesn't really care about that sort of thing. The basic story, it's one of those folklore stories where there had been a slave who had freed himself by coming up with a great way to manufacture shoes.
Oh, I thought he was the son of that slave. Did I get that wrong?
I think he was the slave.
Oh, okay. Okay, go on.
And then he became, maybe you're right. Maybe he's the son of him, but he was an artist.
Yeah.
And he married a white woman, and then.
No. I watched it last night, so I remember a little bit of this.
Oh,
so,
okay.
From what I remember, and I could be wrong, he was the son of the slave who gained his freedom and then invented a way to make like real shoes, like really well or really efficiently, right? And so he is raised sort of a little bit as like as a child of privilege or as much as privilege as you can be at that time, you know, being black and raised in a slave 1860 post-slavery culture. And then what happens is he comes under the notice of a white landowner or a rich white man. And basically commissions him to do a portrait of his daughter, and he falls in love with the daughter and gets her pregnant. And then that's when the awful sort of like lynching and torture and stuff of Tony Todd's spirit or being original character occurs. So I think that's the way I remember it. I could be wrong, but I know that for a fact that he did not marry a white woman. but that he did have an affair with her and then got her pregnant. And then that's it. Like, all bets were off, as they probably would have been at that time.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, basically.
Unfortunately.
But then, like, part of the torture was, you know, covering him with honey.
Yeah.
And letting him be stung to death by bees.
Yeah.
While also, you know, cutting off his hand and I believe his genitals and then setting him on fire.
Yeah.
Which
a siren going by. Yeah. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. Which seems, you know, a little excessive.
Yeah. Oh, sure. But as we know, at that time, certain awful people in society were a bit excessive.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And it was pretty, it's honestly, given some of the stories that I've heard of actual lynchings, this is all a little tame even.
Sure.
But yeah, so that, I feel like the Candyman part of it comes somewhere in there, something involving the honey.
The honey, yeah.
Some part of that.
But they never solidify it. And at one point... At one point, Virginia Madsen, who is fantastic in this movie, I have to say, I was blown away by how good she was. She discovered she's going to investigate, and she goes into this apartment where the Candyman is apparently supposedly hiding out and stuff. And she finds this bag of candy, like old candy, and she opens it up, and one of them has like a razor blade in it.
Yeah.
And they don't investigate that, like none of it,
not
it doesn't
all.
Get expounded upon.
No.
And I'm like, oh, okay, we're gonna get to the Candyman part, and okay, they never get to it, which, okay, fine, that's fine. It can be like an urban legend or a myth or whatever, and it doesn't have to make sense, you know what I mean?
I think that, like, the implication of the bag and, like, the larger sort of theme that they get to, especially towards the end, is this idea of the things people believe in and the power of folktale and myth.
Uh-huh.
That I think the implication there was, you know, more of that people were bringing candy to him as an offering.
Oh, okay.
But also with the razor blade, but also as, like, protection against him.
Yeah.
You know, it was all part of, like, but you're right, it's completely unexamined, unexplained in any way. But I just chalked it up to being, this is part of this this particular community and this particular sort of housing project's belief in the Candyman.
Yeah.
And these are part of the rituals, is that you bring him a bag of candy so he doesn't come into your apartment and kill you.
You know, it's interesting, us talking through it, there's a part of me that's also thinking, like, maybe because the whole thing is about the exploration of myths and urban legends and stories and stuff like that, it could just be sort of like interjecting a bit of, like, that sort of myth of kids being poisoned on Halloween, you know, finding razor blades in their candy, when, you know, statistics actually show that doesn't happen, you know what I mean? And barely ever did, you know what
I
mean?
Exactly.
Maybe there was like one story when we were growing up that might have been factual, you know, but so maybe that had something to do with it. They just threw that in there and they were like, oh, this is like an urban, you know, myth that, you know, kids eat candy given to them by strangers on Halloween and there could be a razor blade in it, you know what I mean? So maybe there's a little bit of that, but
I mean so much of it is about, like, folklore and myth and the power of myth. And, you know, obviously when you're dealing with, like, this figure, this Candyman figure, with his hook hand, that brings to mind, of course, all the classic hook man myths and all of those old stories that we've all heard. And it gives it sort of a feel of verisimilitude. So I wouldn't put it past him. Just like, yeah, you're exactly right. Let's just throw something more in.
yeah. I mean, who knows? But I just found it interesting. And I found it interesting that they never, like, went back to that or even talked about it. But,
right.
You know, whatever. It's a horror movie. I don't need everything explained. You know, why don't we talk a little bit about the plot? Why don't we talk a little bit about what this is actually about? Because that was the thing that I found most sort of interesting about the whole thing, is that how much, again, we talked a little bit about it before, how much the first half or a large chunk of the movie is just exploration into something.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's got such an interesting sort of structure and, in a way, concept behind it. I mean, I'll dive in because it's about this woman played by Virginia Madsen.
Yeah.
Named Helen Lyle, who's a grad student studying urban legends.
Uh-huh.
And she's focusing on this one particular legend, the Candyman, at the Cabrini Green housing project.
Yeah, in Chicago, right?
In Chicago. Yeah. And she and her best friend, played by professional black best friend, Casey Lemons.
who is also a good director.
She's become a really good director. But yeah, in this time in her life, she was mostly in movies as some white lady's very, very yeah. reasonable best friend.
Well, she directed Eve's Bayou.
Yeah.
And Eve's Bayou. I think I saw that in the theater and really liked it.
Yeah, she's a great director. She's a yeah. really good director. I think she's doing a fair amount of TV these days.
Yeah, she did an episode of Luke Cage, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. She's great. I looked her up this afternoon. Yeah. Anyway, yeah. great director. Go on.
And so she starts investigating, and it leads her to the story of a woman. She learns, of course, from the cleaning ladies at her yeah. university. That's well, right. we'll get into the racial. The racial politics of this are so tricky and funky.
Yeah.
And yet, I don't know. We'll
definitely
talk
something I want to talk about, but definitely yeah. go on.
So she learns that there was a woman who was murdered by Candyman in one of these housing project, one of these apartments.
Yeah.
And so she goes to check it out. And all of this time, Helen and her, she's married to an intellectual
professor,
and her friend Bernadette, they all have a sort of, not nonplus, but they're skeptical
sure.
about all these things. They don't believe in them.
As you would be.
As you would be. They're yeah. academics and intellectuals, and they're looking for the underpinnings and all of that. Yeah. And they find in this woman's apartment that the medicine cabinet in her bathroom can pull off the wall and lead to an empty space behind, which is how Helen surmises the actual killers, whoever actually killed this woman, got into the apartment.
Yeah, yeah.
And they go, they're taking pictures in that, like, old movie way that they're somehow always taking pictures of things when they should just put it away.
Yeah.
They're taking pictures in there and they don't notice that the empty apartment next door is full of very beautiful murals, but also very terrifying. In particular, this one really terrifying mural of a man with his mouth wide open, sort yeah. of screaming, laughing, swallowing,
yeah.
With the entrance, with the hole into Ruthie Ann's bathroom at the center of it. It's creepy as hell.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good bit, yeah.
Super creepy. And so she starts investigating it, and basically she meets this little kid, Jake, who tells her he's seen him. Or he knows where she can find the Candyman.
That's right, yeah.
And he leads her to this bathroom, and she's assaulted by a guy, just a guy holding a hook, and it becomes clear that this guy is a drug dealer.
Yeah.
Or gang leader who lives here, and he sort of assaults her, but the cops are called, and he gets arrested, I think.
Well, he calls himself Candyman, so that's right. The thing, is that this guy has taken on the moniker of Candyman in the complex.
What?
And he carries around a hook. So he's calling himself Candyman. So it's a really interesting bit of like misdirection that they yeah. kind of, I mean, we know the history of this movie, so we all know, okay, this is not the Candyman. But I can imagine the first time somebody seeing this movie might have been like, yeah. oh, that's the Candyman. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Exactly.
Like if you went into it and you didn't know anything about it. So it was really interesting bit. And she gets, first of all, like we don't even talk about the fact of, you know, a white woman walking into the projects by herself,
right.
you know, there's this thing that happens during horror movies. And we were talking about it the other day because we were watching another horror movie, which I liked and my wife didn't so much like, called Starry Eyes, which is pretty good. I liked it a lot. But there's this thing in horror movies that particularly I start to notice in October because I start watching horror movies where people do something like really stupid or somebody in the movie has got to act like really dumb and do something really dumb. And depending on the way that the thing is directed or shot or written, or I don't know exactly what it is. You might know better than me because you're an actual writer. You're either going to go with that person once they do the stupid thing or you're not.
Right.
Like
right.
The, and it all seems to be in the presentation of how it's done. Now, in this movie, like when she starts dragging her friend to the projects and then she follows the little boy and she's just walking around, I think the movie was directed in a certain way that there are certain times where the projects do seem ominous and then they don't. And by this point, she had sort of met a neighbor, I think, a woman who had a baby. And so the projects became to seem more like a safe, like, it's okay to be here. You know what I mean? Because she met a woman and the woman had a baby and they were kind of welcoming and they kind of became friendly and they talked a little bit about the Candyman and she got a little bit of information. But you're still sort of like, dude, what are you doing going into the bathroom, you know, in the middle of the projects by yourself? But despite that, anyway, it's a really good scene because it sort of, it does that thing that some horror movies, the payoff of the stupidity plays out, you know what I'm saying? And not necessarily in a lethal way. Does that make sense?
That totally makes sense.
That's what I liked about it.
Like getting into that, a little bit into the racial politics of it, like what's sort of interesting is that I don't think the movie ever treats what she's doing as not stupid.
Yeah, you're right.
Like, I feel like we are supposed to feel to a certain degree that she's not being, she's one, not being very bright, but also she's not being very sensitive, you know?
Yeah.
She's not particularly sensitive to the plight of this woman living in this apartment. She's not particularly, even to the little kid Jake she befriends, she's, you know, kind of using these people. Yeah. And I feel like you're supposed to feel like that. You're supposed to feel like her skeptical sort of very urbane attitude and sort of a little bit, it's not heavy handed, but a little bit looking down at the people here who live in the projects and all of that. And the people who believe in Candyman as being silly or childish, you know. And when she's confronted in the bathroom, it's a little bit in a way a relief because it's so real and so mundane.
Yeah.
That it's a little bit like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's interesting that you sort of say that sort of skepticism and looking down, because it's another aspect of horror movies in that sometimes there's a lead character or a main character who's so focused on what they want to do, like say like Dr. Frankenstein, that they're not paying attention to how sort of obtuse they're being about everything else. You know what I'm saying? Right. And it's sort of like very much a trope in horror movies. And this plays out in a very interesting and different way. And that's a really good call that you mentioned that, because that's such an aspect of horror, of like sci-fi or whatever, where you've got like a lead character who's just like, look, I've got a goal and I'm going to go find it. And nothing's going to sort of get in my way. And I'm going to quote unquote, like use whoever I can to sort of achieve that, you know?
Right. And I'm going to ignore all of the signs that I should not pursue this any further. All of the people who are telling me to not pursue this any further that I'm going to get in over my head. And she does once when she's cornered in the bathroom and assaulted by the drug dealer Candyman.
Yeah.
And then again, immediately after that, after she's identified him and the guy goes to jail and it seems like everything's fine and we're midway through the movie and she finds herself in a parking garage confronted by the real Candyman.
Yeah.
And that Candyman has his point now is because she's essentially debunked the myth.
Yeah.
And said that the fake Candyman is the only one. He now needs to start killing people.
Yes.
To bring back the fear and the belief that people had in him.
Yes.
And it's a remarkably quick turnaround. Yes. I mean, she basically, you know, exposes the drug dealer Candyman. And like 24 hours later, real Candyman is like, hey, people don't believe in me anymore.
Yeah.
The rest of the movie is basically Candyman killing, using, it's actually unclear how exactly he's working this, whether or not he's possessing her to make her kill people, or just in one circumstance, he basically sets up a situation where it looks like she's killed twice.
Yeah, no, twice. Yeah.
Where it looks like she's killed someone, but he has, but it's hard to tell what's happening in reality, if there is such a thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the thing that they play with a lot is like, is there a real Candyman? Is it an embodiment, or is he using her to do the horrible deeds that he's, wow, you know, wants to do? Like, is he possessing her? Is he taking over her body? Or is he like doing it and setting her up? That's sort of the one thing. But the other thing too is that it's funny to me because there is a decent amount of like sort of her own stupidity that kind of falls in, that helps her, yeah, fall into these traps. Because like, so like the number one thing that you learn on any TV drama, on any episode of Law and Order, yeah, or anything, is that when you come across a sort of murder scene, you don't pick up the weapon. Like,
right,
if you're a bystander, you don't pick up the weapon.
Yep.
So the thing that Candyman does, like in the sort of parking lot, is like he confronts her and he says, you know, his like cryptic messaging and, you know, worship me or whatever, or yeah, come be with me, or, you know, I don't remember the exact wording. I'm sure that there's a Candyman super fan out there who's like, how could you not know this? But so she kind of like passes out and she wakes up and she's like in a pool of blood in a bathroom, and she comes out and she opens the door and she hears some screaming, and she looks down, and the first thing that she sees on the floor is blood, and yep, there's a meat cleaver. And yep, so what does she do? She picks up the meat cleaver. Right? And I'm like, no, don't pick up the meat cleaver. Don't, like, that's like my first reaction. It's like, right? No, don't. And then she has it in her hand, and it turns out to be the woman in the apartment who she had befriended earlier with the baby. And at first I thought, oh, no, because A, there's like blood everywhere, you know, and you see that the dog's head has been like cut off,
yep,
you know, the pit bull, yep, that she had to protect, cool, herself from whatever gang members or things that were going on in the projects. The head of the dog has been cut off. But right, I was thinking like, oh no, they did something horrible. Like, this thing just, yes, kicked into overdrive. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's definitely a moment. And usually it seems like horror movies, it's like at the 20-minute mark. We're talking like this happened like 45 minutes. Like, yep, like you said, like, and I was like not expecting it to hit this hard. Like, I was like, yeah, oh, because I thought like somebody, spoilers, I thought somebody had done something to the baby. And then I, right, was like, oh my God, like, This is really bad. But it turns out that the baby was just missing. But anyway, they get into a confrontation. The cops break in, and she has the meat cleaver, and she's like assaulting the woman because the woman's attacking her, being like, "What, right, did you do with my baby?" And it's just a mess. And she just ends up falling into like a situation where it's just like,
yeah,
you could have, you know, you could have just avoided this by not picking up the meat cleaver. Exactly. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Because yeah, the cops bust in. And now she is on top of the woman who lives in the apartment.
Yes.
Covered in blood, holding a bloody meat cleaver.
Yes.
While the woman screams bloody murder. So.
Yes. It's not looking good for you.
The optics are real bad. And yeah, she is immediately arrested and, mm-hmm, suspected of murder.
Yes.
Sort of kidnapping. Well, it's like she's immediately suspected of killing the baby. And everyone wants to know what she did with the baby.
Well, you know, here's the thing, and I'm going to step in with a couple of criticisms of the writing, you, yeah, know, and I'm not a writer, but... Nope.
You know writing.
But, so, the first thing is that a little bit of... might be a nitpick, but at one point, they say that she's under arrest, and, right, they put her in jail, and she calls her husband, and her husband's not there. This is another subplot that the husband is having sort of an affair with one of his, yes, students. You know, and that's telegraphed like miles away. Like, we know that it's happening. There's no doubts or whatever. No. I think that part could have been played a little more subtly or something, but it, mm-hmm, wasn't. Maybe it wasn't meant to be. Either way, she calls her husband. Her husband's not there. Eventually, her husband does bail her out. When they're on their way out and the press is like hounding them, her, yes, lawyer literally says, "My client has not been charged with anything." And I'm like, you can't be arrested unless you're charged with something. Like,
yes.
Duh. So anyway, that happens like in a fraction of a second, but I'm such a needly nitpicker that I picked, yep, up on it right away. And I was like, no, 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 no.
Weird. because like they let her go. It's very weird, but like the situation does not look good for Helen.
No, it doesn't look good, but I will say this. So we're talking about a woman who, and I to go back to the restroom beating scene, the thing that I wanted to say about that scene is that the assault happens like off camera, sort of, like she gets hit and they mess her up, like, because there's really good eye makeup. Like, they totally messed up her eye. And as it's healing, they show, like, a month goes by. But, so the thing that I'm thinking, and, like, obviously this is a thing that would sidetrack the whole script in a way and, you know, develop a side plot that would add 20 minutes to it. But I have to say it. So we're talking about a woman who was assaulted by a big-time drug dealer in the projects and puts him away in jail. Okay.
Yep.
So she's going to tell the police, I just woke up in the bathroom. Like, I was in a parking lot and a man approached me, you know, and said he was a Candyman. And then I woke up in the bathroom and I don't know like what happened. Like I woke up and there was, you know, blood everywhere and it was a mess and I had nothing to do with this. And there's nobody that goes like, could she have been set up? Like, could this be like revenge for the drug dealer that, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, there's a logical sort of explanation in a way, if you were to think outside the box, I guess, for what happened. Does that make sense or am I reaching too much?
I mean, I think you're making sense, but I mean, the movie's obviously not interested in that.
Yeah.
Like, I think there's,
I hope Jordan Peele adds that if he uses like the same elements of the script. But anyway, go ahead.
I mean, there are so many questions that one you would think the police would ask or wonder about how this and why all of a sudden she would behave in this manner
at all.
Like, lots and lots and lots of questions that are not asked.
Yeah.
But of course, many of those questions get sort of subsumed into the next thing that happens, which is she goes home.
Yeah.
Candyman appears to her again.
Yes.
Attacks her.
Yeah.
And then proceeds to kill her best friend.
Yes.
And once again, her with a bloody instrument.
Yeah.
And that one is, that one looks worse.
Yeah.
For poor Helen.
Yeah.
Because, you know.
It's not looking good.
Yeah. Her friend is completely gutted and she winds up in a mental institution. And it's basically, and here's where the subplot, because like in that first sort of like domestic drama-y part in the beginning of the movie, there are definitely lots of intimation that her marriage is sort of rocky and she's having issues with her husband and she's worried about him cheating on her. And that definitely feels like when she's in the mental hospital, it definitely feels like her husband has railroaded her there.
Yeah. Or at the very least, well, it's funny because that doesn't come, that sort of idea doesn't really pop into your head until later when she sort of escapes the mental institution with the help of the Candyman.
Yeah.
Who at that sort of point is a little bit to me like a little bit of a Batman villain. He's like setting her up for another crime and another crime. But anyway, you know, I'll let that go. Like the whole thing of like her, is she railroaded? Is she not? It's sort of like what is he gonna, like when she's in the institution and she gets put there, it's very much sort of like, well, what are you going to do? She obviously killed two people. I mean, he's the one that came home and discovered, you know, the body. So at that point, like, I don't know that I buy the sort of railroading thing. It's only after she, like, escapes and it's like, oh, did he abandon her? But then there's another part of me that's like, well, wouldn't you? I mean, maybe you wouldn't start having an affair with a student or anything, but wouldn't you just be like, I don't know, maybe she just needs to go to the institution, like, you know?
No, that's totally legit. And I mean, I'm with you. And like, to the credit of Xander Berkeley,
he's great.
Plays her husband, he's really good. Yeah. And he actually, even though he is, spoiler alert, proven to be a terrible philanderer, and kind of a jerk,
he usually plays in a lot of stuff. But anyway, go ahead.
He does actually feel very genuinely upset.
Yes,
and concerned. And like later in the film, when he has opportunity to grieve, he makes it feel very real.
Yeah, yeah. gets his moment for sure.
He's not like Snidely Whiplash, you know, twirling his
mustache
at the prospect of sending her off to the funny farm.
Yeah.
But you're right. It is the only real option here, and try to figure out, you know, why his wife has snapped and kidnapped and maybe killed a baby and a dog, and then also her best friend.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And is raving about all of these things having been done by someone else, some invisible boogeyman.
Yeah. That
is an urban legend.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. The Candyman that she specifically is looking into, you know.
Right. It definitely has the feel of a psychotic break.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Which is, like, I'm sure that people were wondering, like, oh, did she study this so much that she became it? You know what I mean? Nobody says that, which I would have liked a line like that by one of maybe the psychiatrists. Like, maybe you were studying this so much that, you know, you fell into it, because that could have played more into sort of like the, like, delving into insanity. Because, I mean, as much as they do sort of present Candyman as like a real thing, like a dude, like a being that's coming, you know, there is sort of a little bit of that. And that's a little bit of the problem that I had with the movie. And maybe it's just this doesn't want to be that kind of movie, but there's such an opportunity there to be like, is he real? Is he not real? Right. Is she just crazy? And they touch on it a little bit, but not enough in my.
No, I mean, you know. I don't feel like the movie ever wants us to think that Candyman is not real.
Sure, sure, sure.
At no point do they ever want us to not absolutely believe that the Candyman is real and is the reason all of these things are happening.
Sure.
Which is also interesting, because you're right. They could have taken that tack, and they could have gone for something that lived in more ambiguity and more the early part of the Babadook, you know?
Yeah.
Like, is she just snapping? But here, yeah, they went. He's a real dude.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's a bit of a missed opportunity, and maybe like a reveal at the end that like he is really real. You know what I mean? Was something that could have been played out more powerfully. You know, I mean, you could have had Tony Todd there and been menacing and all that. But I think if you'd have played it, like you said, a bit more ambiguously and a bit more like, what is really happening here?
Yeah.
That it could have been an effective thing. Obviously, that's not what it is. I mean, no. And I think it does fall into the, you know, they were trying to make the next Freddy. They were trying to make the next Jason, you know, and sort of thing doesn't play to it.
Exactly. It is definitely not an artsy, it's not aiming to be an art house film. You know, it's not a, what's that guy who did like the Lair of the White Worm, Ken Russell?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
You know, that it's not living in that place. It's not Picnic at Hanging Rock here. It's
like Jacob's Ladder or something.
Even Jacob's Ladder. This is a step above a grindhouse B horror movie based on a Clive Barker short story.
Yeah, like, it's got a budget though. It's really well shot.
It's gorgeously made. Bernard Rose did a really good job with it, and like, there's nothing. I'm not faulting it for that, but it just doesn't have those aspirations.
Yeah. It's interesting. I looked up Bernard Rose, and he also directed Immortal Beloved, which I remember loving when I saw it in the theater. And then like after that, it doesn't seem like anything much of like real big substance.
Though he's still working. I looked him up too. He did that Frankenstein movie that came out a couple years ago.
Yeah, which I did not see. So I don't know.
But yeah, he definitely has not reached the heights of Immortal Beloved again.
No. But I mean, that's the thing. It's like, you look at this movie, and I think that's part of why, you know, Amy liked it, is it's professionally shot. Like, it doesn't look cheap. I mean, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't seem like you said, like grindhouse. It avoids like all that stuff until sort of like you get to the very end. But it's very well, I think it's very well shot. I think it's like really well executed. I think like the scenes play out really, really well and like believable, you know, and so, you know, the director does a really good job during the whole movie of making it not seem sort of like B grade or C grade horror.
No, I mean, there aren't even that many sort of jump scares. Like we're saying, and it's mostly once the gore kicks in, then there's a lot of gore.
Yes.
There's definitely a lot of gore. There's a lot of blood. Yes. The one shot of Bernadette Casey Lemons' body post-ravaging is pretty gross.
Yeah.
And some of the later images are kind of disturbing, but it definitely lives more in the like I said, the pervasive sense of dread.
Yeah.
But to just sort of wrap up the plot, so she's in the mental institution. Candyman breaks her out. And the promise that he's offering her now is he has the woman's baby. He's going to kill the baby unless she allows herself to be sacrificed, be murdered by him, basically, to reignite his legend.
Yeah.
But then after she gets out of the mental institution and goes back to the Cabrini Green and finds the baby, then he's a little bit like, nah, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm gonna kill you both, and that's what I'm gonna need, because apparently, in sort of tribute to him, once a year, everyone in Cabrini Green burns all of their garbage in the front yard in a huge bonfire.
Yeah,
which again is an odd, not particularly American, or it's just an odd thing that exists in this movie that you sort of just have to let it go.
Sure.
You know,
yeah.
But so he takes the baby into the pyre and has her there as well, and it gets set alight. But she manages to pull herself together enough to save the baby and leave him trapped in the pyre, and she dies of her wounds.
Yeah.
And at her funeral, all the people from the projects come and throw the hook.
Yeah.
Into her grave.
Yeah.
Which seems ill-advised.
Well, okay, so this is where I was a little bit confused. So, like, she goes into the pyre to save the baby because that's where Candyman takes her. And then the little boy sees Candyman in the thing, and he's like, oh, I can burn him. Or he sees Candyman's there. And so then he gets everybody to go out and burn the thing, and she's able to get the baby and escape from Candyman, and she gets burned and, you know... That's how she dies. But like when they come to the funeral and they toss the hook into the, you know, and Vanessa Williams does a great job as the mom of the baby. She was really good too.
She's really good.
Yeah. And I looked up her credits and I'm like, oh my God, I've seen her in so much stuff and just didn't remember. When she throws the hook, are they doing this to honor her? Or they're disgusted by her? Or I mean, like, did she redeem herself?
She redeamed herself. And this is what I'm saying about the weird sort of social, racial politics of this. Because the movie is so much about this white woman. And it's, you know, it's Virginia Madsen, who is about as, like, blonde.
Aryan. Yeah.
And Aryan looking as you can imagine. About as Nordic as you can imagine. A white woman goes, you know, into the projects. She has all of these sort of interactions. She's menaced through most of the movie by large, intimidating black men, but it never feels sensational, which is interesting. And then she does, like, she's obviously partly responsible for at least the murder of this woman's dog and all the sort of terror involving the baby and all these issues, but she does redeem herself by saving the baby. And I took that moment as a bit of, like, we were coming to pay our respects, because everyone is actually dressed in their, like, funeral finest.
Sure.
While Xander Berkeley looks on in sort of shock and amazement. Yeah. And that it's a little bit saying the mantle has passed.
Yeah.
That she has taken the place, in a way, of Candyman.
Uh-huh. Yes.
As the person that they're going to tell stories about going into the future.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, because when she throws the hook and she has this look of disdain on her face. And so that's why I was confused. I was like, is this that she's like disgusted, or she's like done with Candyman, or, you know, maybe a little bit of a line in there might have helped me understand like what was going on. Because at first I thought, oh, they're coming to honor her. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, she tosses like the bloody hook in the grave. And I was like, okay, maybe a rose might have been nice. Like, I don't, you know, it's interesting to me because, like, I was watching this movie and, you know, and then, you know, to wrap it up, you know, Xander Berkeley goes home with his under not underage, young student, and they're shacking up in their
exceptionally braless. I wanted
to know
that she is, and it's very cold in that apartment.
As horror movie actresses were wont to do back in the 80s and early 90s. But that's when you get to see him have his moment of like grief and like, where did this all go wrong? Because he's kind of like hiding out in the bathroom, and the girlfriend is like, oh, I'm going to make dinner. Do you want dinner? What do you want? And he's kind of like trying to brush her off, like kind of being a jerk to her. And then he looks in the mirror and he's saying like her name, and he's saying, oh, Helen, Helen. And obviously he says it like 5 times.
He says it 5 times.
Yeah. And then obviously Helen comes and she's all burned up and kills him at the end. And so she's taking the place of Candyman, which is like really weird to me, because it's like, this is like the perfect opportunity to make another movie called Bride of Candyman, or like, you know what I'm saying? And they didn't do that. They gave, you know, she could have been the next sort of, you know, candy person.
It has
person.
That feel, because then the sort of final shot of it, and it's a really gorgeous one, is you go back to that, to the weird burned out apartment where his mural was, and now it's this gorgeous mural of her.
Yeah. It's interesting. And so I liked a lot of the plot and all that stuff. I thought this was like a really good movie, but it's funny because I texted you earlier in the day, and I was actually thinking about it while I was watching the movie. I mean, I do want to address sort of like the racial politics of everything. I mean, I was watching this movie and I was very much like, this is racist. I was watching it, and you know, I've had friends, I'm a California liberal, I'm not gonna lie, I've had friends be like, oh, you're too sensitive and blah blah blah, but I'm like, I don't know, like I was watching it and I'm like, let me see, white woman stalked by a black guy, tall scary black guy during the whole movie, and then she's like killing people and going into the projects, and the projects are scary, and it's filled. And so like I typed in to Google last night before I went to bed, I said, is Candyman racist? And there were like all these articles like talking about like disputing it. And I guess there was a lot of controversy when the movie came out, because a lot of people were protesting like the stereotypes that the movie sort of like embraced or, you know, indulged in, like, you know, the gang members and the spooky projects, and like that these people are not like people, they're sort of just cardboard cutouts. And then you had other people arguing like, well, you know, it's like, what are you going to do? Particularly, I believe, like black civil rights leaders at the time. It's like, well, you've got a black actor in the lead of a horror movie. I'm not going to complain about this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they also have a scene in the movie where she talks about the apartment where she lives and talks about sort of like how her apartment building was originally set up to be like a project, sort of like a public housing project, and it doesn't get turned into it because the city council or whatever felt like that building wouldn't have been walled off from the rest of the city enough.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so it talks about stuff like that, but then it sort of engages in stuff that when I was like watching it, I was like, this is racist. Like, I felt like, but then, you know, texting you today, you sort of had a more nuanced opinion about it. And I was like, okay, like maybe I did see it the wrong way, or maybe I am being too jump the gun about it.
I don't see it as racist. I see it as a little tone deaf, that there's, you know, certainly in the early scenes in particular, it feels the black characters feel a little stereotypical, except for Bernadette, who again is playing the sort of stereotypical friend, like I mentioned. But you know, when we first meet Anne Marie, she's a little sassy sort of black woman in the hood, and sort of the same thing with the superstitious, with the two superstitious cleaning ladies and all of that. But it's still like the characters, Jake is a really full character. Anne Marie, like you said, you wind up feeling a credible amount of sympathy for her, and she has a little bit of an arc, and growth in this thing. And in the end, you know, maybe it's a white savior thing, but in the end, Helen does save the baby at great cost to herself. And that's why I see that last scene is less like, we're angry about her, and more just sort of we're come to pay our respects, but we know what we're sort of creating.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that you say tone deaf, though, because like for me, like, what does that mean? I mean, isn't that sort of like racist anyway? Is that racism light? Like, I mean,
racism light is a way of putting it. It's just sort of like they didn't. And this again, this was 1992. So racial politics
were
very different. Business was very different. Racial sensitivities were different.
Sure. You
know? So it doesn't feel like it was anything intentional. It doesn't feel that's like the
mean spirited is what you're saying.
Exactly. Like the great thing about the way Candyman is. And I was just sort of Googling some stuff about it. I think one of the things that helps is Bernard Rose, who directed it, is English.
Okay.
He wrote and directed it. Even though he wanted to shoot it in America, and he sees Candyman as a sort of romantic figure.
Oh.
And it feels that way. It doesn't feel like, while it doesn't, he's menacing, obviously, and evil, but it never feels like, here's the scary black dude. He's never, it's never like a Harry, it's not like a Dirty Harry movie.
Okay. You know, yeah, I see
like
what you're
even
saying.
Even Jake, but even the sort of the Anne-Marie, all of them, none of them speak in a very sort of stereotypical way. Everyone speaks differently. There are actually a number of black people in this movie because one of the cops is black, her friend is black. Like, and we see sort of a range of attitudes and feelings. So it never feels that's what I mean about feels like there are a few tone-deaf moments. But it feels like it is trying really, and with the slavery background and the racial violence background for Candyman, it is trying to make a connection between the two things, between how black people used to be treated and how they are treated now. But it does not – it's also not particularly interested in any of that either.
I mean, it doesn't delve too deep, and it's funny because the other thing that sort of like bugged me towards at the end was sort of like, well, you have this sort of like great villain, and then at the end it's sort of like subverted and taken over by another white person. You know what I mean? I was like, wait a minute, like Candyman's gone and now she's what, the candy person? Like, I felt like that was kind of lame. And then obviously it could, maybe Virginia Madsen didn't want to do a sequel or whatever, but obviously you had, you know, the great Tony Todd, so why would you waste that and not bring him back in something? But I'm thinking just like off the top of my head, like you could have had a plot where they fight for the moniker, or like she's trying to not be candy. You know what I mean? Like there's a lot of interesting things you could have done with a sequel. I haven't seen any of the sequels.
No.
Maybe that's what they did do, but I hear they're not very good. But there were definitely things when I was watching and I was just like, whoa, like what is going on here? You know,
but you are right.
Some of the reading that I did mention that exactly the things that you're talking about, where there is a wide breadth of characters. They don't all talk the same. Many of them sort of do have like a grounded reality. They're just not caricatures, like her friend and the mother of the baby and stuff like that. They feel like real characters and not just sort of like inserted into the plot. So
exactly. And not really there to serve like just her arc. Like they're doing their sort of own thing. Like there are no magical Negroes despite there being a ghost in this movie.
Despite there being a ghost. Well, yeah. Okay. Gotcha. There is one sort of, I guess. Sort of. I don't know.
But he even has his own, journey. He has his own sort of goal that he's trying to do.
Sure. So let me ask you this. What would you do or what would you like to see like Jordan Peele do like with a remake?
Ooh.
Like how do you think like...
I mean, I would love for him to really like... I'd love for him to bring out that racial subtext. I would love for him to like really talk much, much more about it. I mean, I don't think that you would need or should like necessarily like alter the plot all that much. But just to really, really drive home the carpetbagger aspect of her going in there, her blindness to what she's sort of awakening and dealing with. I think it's going to be great. I have no doubts about what he could possibly do with this story or this world.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, having seen the movie now, you know, I had heard that he was making a remake and I was like, oh, okay. And having seen, obviously, Get Out and loving it, thinking it was like one of the best movies of what, last year, right? Yeah. Time goes by so fast, I can't even remember. But, you know, I would be really interesting. I would be really interested to see him do a remake, because there's a lot of people who would be like, oh, why are we remaking stuff? But I have a feeling that he would have a really good take, like, on whatever was going on in this movie and make it very smart. I mean, he signed on as producer, though. I mean, do you know if he's writing? He's not going to direct.
I don't know. It's through his production company, so who knows? I mean, I'd be surprised if he didn't. But I also, in a way, trust him. That sure. Like, he'll find someone who's going to do something interesting with it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have to say, I really enjoyed this. I mean, the other thing that I kind of wanted to say is that it doesn't. Yeah, I mean, and I said a little bit about it earlier. I mean, to me, it's funny because I've watched a couple of movies, like particularly in this series that we're doing, but other horror movies too, where it's like there's this sort of thing of like, I don't know, like this is not like sort of your typical horror movie. It almost sort of like tries to play out like a Hitchcock thing. It doesn't achieve that success, like where you're sort of like very much on the edge of your seat the whole time, like a lot of Hitchcock movies do. But it's like, it's funny how this thing has become sort of like a legendary horror movie, because to me, it's very atypical of what we were seeing at the time.
Yeah.
And even atypical of kind of what we see now, like with The Conjuring and a lot of these like sort of like, you know, other horror movies that just keep coming out and, you know, kind of fail to impress me or make me want to go to the theater to see them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's just interesting to me as I was watching and I was like, is this a horror movie? Like, what is going on? And then, like we said, sort of middle of the film, I'm like, okay, I think this qualifies. Like, right. I think, but it plays out much differently. And at one point I was like, oh, this is more like a thriller sort of thing. But it's very well polished. I mean, I was surprised. I was really, really surprised because I've seen a lot of horror movies. I've seen a lot of like 90s. Obviously, we grew up were becoming sort of adults in the 90s. And, mm-hmm. and you know, there was a lot of like cheesy stuff out there with like decent budgets. And this thing like made use of like all the tools that it had, and they made like a really good movie. I mean, I'm surprised I haven't seen it before, and I'm actually surprised by how much I liked it, because in the beginning of the movie, I wasn't losing patience, but I was like, this doesn't seem like normal. You know right. what I mean?
Yeah, it's super, super slow. Like I said, I feel like it just was a bit ahead of its time that uh-huh. like, even if Jordan Peele made essentially a shot-for-shot remake of this, and updated it only slightly, it really feels like it fits in the, it follows Babadook, you know, It Comes at Night or whatever that one other one was called, that sort of place, even A Quiet Place, of these much more sort of smaller, more artsy, slightly more, if you want to ding them, slightly more pretentious, but slightly more like painterly movies.
Thoughtful. Yeah.
These more
although
thoughtful.
I don't agree with It Follows. I was just like, anyway, go ahead.
But I mean, I love It Follows. I love it so.
I may have to watch it again. I don't know.
Oh man, no. I loved it like immediately.
I didn't.
Clearly. But I'm just saying like it fits in that mold more sure. than Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah.
Or,
Friday
you
the 13th.
Know, Friday the 13th kind of movie, or even, like I said, even something, any of those.
Yeah. I'm wondering if, like, the people behind it, well, I guess it was successful, because in the end, it sort of, like, created a franchise, and you know, the character sort of did achieve, like, sort of cult horror status, you know. But I'm wondering if people were watching it, like, when, you know, they did the final cut or the production people, and they're like, what the hell is this? What did you give me? Where are all the teenagers with their tops off?
And exactly.
Like, why isn't there more blood and blah, 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 and all that stuff? You know, it's just like, but it ended up being something a little bit sort of more cerebral. And, yeah, you know, I sort of give it credit for that. And that's interesting to say about a Clive Barker movie, because mostly I only know like Nightbreed and the Hellraiser movies, right? And
exactly,
I was not like, crazy yeah. about any of that stuff yeah. growing up, even this as a horror fan.
This is none of those things. This is yeah. a whole other kind of creature than, yeah. It's crazy.
It's trying to be smarter than that, in my opinion. All right. Well, any final thoughts on Candyman, Jay, or?
No, I mean, I think I've said it all. Like, I really liked it. It also brought like a nice feeling of nostalgia back. Like, just sort of remembering how I felt about horror movies when I was in like high school and early college. I was just talking to someone about the other day, and like really being a Fangoria kid and really being into horror and all the different sort of forms of horror, you know, in that era, and then sort of falling out of it in the torture porn years, and now kind of getting back into it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. For me, it was just like a really nice kind of surprise. I mean, I really enjoyed it, and I thank you for recommending it, because this probably would have been one of those things that I thought I had seen and just been like, yeah, I don't need to see that again, and had never really seen it, which I don't know if that happens to other people, but it has happened to me. Maybe I've seen too many movies where I'm just like, or too many clips of documentaries or whatever, where I've just been like, yeah, I think I've seen that, but I didn't really see it. So for me, it was like a really nice surprise, and I was kind of impressed. I mean, it's a very different sort of beast than what I was, that I'm sort of kind of usually used to when I see horror movies. And I sort of appreciate, usually the slow build like frustrates me to no end.
Right.
And this was a sort of slow build, but it was an interesting one. It wasn't, and it didn't drag for me. Like, no. I was engaged with the lead actress, probably because she was really great, and she was very compelling, and she is beautiful. Like, it's funny. We were, I'm blanking out on her name, but we were looking at her and we were like, man, she looks like Scully from the X-Files.
She
like,
really she does. I never really thought about that.
We were looking, and I was like, oh my, because Amy was going, oh, she looks like, I was like, she looks just like Gillian Anderson from the X-Files. Like, I was like, wow, she looks a lot like her. And I'm trying to think of like other, I mean, Virginia Madsen ended up in a lot of like B movies, like a lot of like not really great stuff, but she was a good actress.
She was a really good actress. And yeah, she did sort of like languish in B movies and sort of like Potboilers. I feel like she's had one or two other really good roles. Like I'm blanking on them now, you know?
Yeah. I'm trying to look at if she's doing it. She's still working. She's doing stuff.
She's still working. So. She was on a TV show a couple years ago.
Yeah. It looks like she's on a miniseries now or something. But either way, she did voices for Voltron.
Yeah.
One voice. Yeah, Designated Survivor. I don't know what that is. Oh, that's that.
Yeah, that's the What's It's movie. That's the. Yeah.
Kiefer
Sutherland.
Kiefer Sutherland. Yeah. Jack from 24. Okay. Great. Well, no, I'm glad that she is still working, because I thought she was really great, and I definitely appreciated her back in the day. And I know that for a while it was like, what are you doing? Like, why are you doing it? But, you know, ain't nothing going on but the rent. So
exactly. Hey, you gotta work.
All right. So this has been the Part-Time Fanboy episode of Candyman. My name is Christian Horn. I've been on the line with Jay Holtham. Thank you for listening. You can check us out on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all that great stuff. And the email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. Thank you for listening. And you know what we didn't do, Jay?
What?
We did not do Who Can Take a Sunrise, Sprinkle It with Dew, Cover It with Chocolate and a Miracle or Two. We didn't do any of that. Come on. How could we have missed that?
How did we do this entire thing and not once met Sammy Davis Jr.? I don't know.
I know. The Candyman. Oh, the Candyman. All right. Thank you for listening. And we will be back with another episode of Part-Time Fanboy. Bye.
Bye.
Part-time fanboy. Boy.
Part-time Sandra doing my thing.
Fanboy.com.